It's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio this afternoon, Peter House. And I have a question to start off with, Peter. And I'm going to ask, I don't think it's in quite the form of a test, but are you familiar with the Dunning-Kruger effect?
Dunning-Kruger, if I remember that correctly, is that... doesn't that have to do with competency and confidence?
Oh, yes. Go. Oh. What else? Now, you've got the top layer of this, and this is particularly pertinent given our topic today, I think, the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Mm.
To remind those, and maybe ourselves, since I had just reviewed this beforehand, or else I wouldn't be speaking quite so confidently, that... these were two researchers who looked at why people who are arguably and measurably not particularly competent overestimate their abilities in any a particular field. And a very competent person in a particular field tends not to do that. I mean, we're restricting to a field because they might still do this, or they might fall into another effect, which is to overestimate the competency of other people. So if you're very competent, you may forget that the rest of the world doesn't do this. So our topic today, in part, has to do with something you've been working on and you've been talking to groups about, and that... roughly the, if I'm correct, and help me out here, the whole question of cybersecurity or knowing how well protected you are. And so I thought I would take that first theme that I've just outlined and say, is this at work? Because arguably, again, many people, maybe most people, are not particularly competent at understanding the dangers and or problems associated with any of the computer systems they use at home, in their offices, wherever. But they may think they really do because of if that Dunning-Kruger effect is at work here. So what's your initial response to that as we kick off our discussion here today?
Well, I think that anybody who seriously works in cybersecurity is my advisor in college had a passage on his website, and I think it's still there, that any math problem worth solving is one that kind of hits you in the face and wakes you up. And I'm totally paraphrasing, but that's the emotional image that I have from reading his passage, like, wow, yeah, that's true. And cybersecurity is a lot, very much in that way as well, too, where there's a vast ocean of complexity, of challenge out there. And so anybody who works in this field likely doesn't feel like they've ever made it so much.
Okay. So, given what we've just described about both the field, this whole arena of security and around data systems and computers and phones and all the rest of it, how do we have a listener who may be part of that great group that doesn't know it all but thinks they know more perhaps than they do? What's the approach best used? And maybe this is a metaphor for the rest of life as well. It could be.
Well, golly. I mean, there's a bit of the sort of the human condition problem here as well, too, which is that the people that oftentimes consume a service or utilize that's not a good word. That means to, well, maybe utilize, but use as well too, a product to get something done. Doesn't typically need to know the ins and outs, right?
Right.
if it's beyond changing brakes or a filter, I'm done, right? I can't do, transmission rebuild or anything like that on my car. I'd like to, and I'm impressed by anybody who can, especially people who don't do that day in and day out.
Right.
So there's part of the challenge, of course, is that for any technology to be adopted widespread, the people that use it can't all be experts in it. I think the high level answer is going to be a little surprising. We actually want to look at where product liability looks.
Ah,
right. So one of the differences in the IT industry from other industries is that if there's a failure to resolve, if there's a product problem, Chevy went through a thing, right? Big thing,
sure.
Right? Massive recall. I think maybe the biggest in history.
Well, the Takata airbag thing might be big as well.
Yeah. Which both are, sort of the population, obviously, whenever something happens. But, I think even in gross percentage, if we were to look at it, I'd say, it's interesting that these two very large recall things have happened in recent history.
Right.
Even if we get away from the sheer numeracy of it. I think that we don't have something similar to that in the IT industry. So let me give you a concrete example. So let's say I'm firewall vendor XYZ, mm-hmm. Acme firewalls, even better. And I'm producing these, and I have a vulnerability that's just due to the challenges of coding, which is very hard work. And somebody drives a Mac truck right on through a digital Mac truck and hauls one of my customers' data right out, ends up on Hong Kong, which, by the way, it's happened.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who got a phone call once from the FBI. Do you know where your data is? No, I don't. It's in Hong Kong. Oh, my. And so that data gets exfiltrated out.
Right.
And to that effect, you're not liable. If it's a HIPAA violation, for example, the organization is going to be held at fault. But where you're at fault was that you trusted a vendor to be timely, and they weren't. You trusted them to protect you, and they didn't. I mean, it kind of goes back to that airbag question, which is when there's an engineering problem,
mm-hmm.
Who's liable? In that sense, so this is a challenge we've had in the industry for a while.
So even at what might be called the lower level of use, where there have been offered to at a consumer level a variety of virus protection programs and so on, I think buried probably in the small print is buyer beware. But that's where this idea that, well, how much can I find out to know if there are half a dozen or whatever number of items, pieces of software I can purchase to protect myself, that once I've done it, do I have to be on alert every day, every moment? and do I think, for example, I can relax because at least for the near term, I have something protecting me. And I assume that scales up to the size that you're talking about, industrial strength protection, firewalls, things of that sort.
So the challenge with antivirus is that it's not the threat vector that it used to be.
Okay.
So when we look at hackers, and where they choose to spend their time, they're not going to spend time developing viruses. And part of that is because the technology is actually quite mature,
okay,
and capable. So, there's obviously a skill range, right? You've got your amateurs and your other folks, and then you got people who might be working for nation states. So you got the whole gamut, just like you do in any industry. And you look at the technology and you go, if I, for example, if I get somebody to click on a link in an email, that allows a Pandora's box of malware to come rushing in. And the antivirus, because of the way that it's architected, has to assume that it's, I know what I'm doing. Or what often commonly happens is that the code itself is encoded. In this case, this is an industry term that basically means that it's built in such a way to avoid detection by antivirus.
Sure.
So it comes rushing in. This is a very common exploit, for example, is Microsoft Word documents.
Mm-hmm.
And a nice little social engineering hack of, might come in, look, and they'll have in the title like purchase order or
sure.
invoice.
Right.
And you got something and it says, if the text doesn't look right, click enable macros, right? And so, and the text of source is purposely blurred out or it's
right,
somehow funky.
Right.
And so you click on it and wah, right, here it comes. And it's coming in such a way that the antivirus, that's why we see those grid type technologies now where they're trying to get early detection and backport it quickly. For other folks so that you don't have a widespread, really epidemic.
Right. Okay. Stop it soon enough, add it to the next set of features in the next iteration of the software and tell people about it.
Yeah. I mean, what they're looking for is signatures of segments of code. And if it fits a particular profile, they're going to classify it and block it. And so, yeah, once they figure out what the digital signature looks like, they'll add it to the dictionary. And that's basically what you're doing when you click the update and get the latest signatures.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So it feels to me like we're in this conversation, even so far, we're looking in two directions. We're looking inward at our own circumstance for perhaps our own collection of devices and small business network and so on. But then we're also looking outward at larger scale that can happen with the backbone of the internet itself, not to mention very large corporations that have somehow managed to gather a lot of information about us. And every so often pops up something on media that says, oh, 110 million customers, Social Security and other information has just been revealed to whoever it is that has decided to take that information. So is this a scary world? Where are we in the game? Are we just fair game? And everyone is, there's no place to hide except to step off the digital networks completely. And even then, I'm not sure.
That's a difficult line of inquiry because, like Tim Berners-Lee, one of the inventors of the internet, just recently said that he's a digital optimist and he himself feels like we're standing on a precipice. Technology oftentimes, it's a lot better now than it used to be, but back then when the internet was being worked on as a platform of commerce, that was not a consideration. Neither was, we didn't have anthropologists. We didn't have people who by trade study the human condition involved in the architecture of the technology. So because it's so malleable and, at the end of the day, when you look at a threat, it's literally the manipulation of bits and bytes. When I look at a presentation or write up on a threat, they typically will have the actual memory signatures and what the hex is there for, and they'll say, well, this is where the password is and so on and so forth. So it's a very low mathematical manipulation of what's supposed to be interpreted by a program. And this is just part of the architecture. So it's very difficult for me. One, I'm in the industry, and I feel like a little bit of like an actuary sometimes. You know, I'm trying to have to, you know, see all these different vulnerabilities, not freak out about them, you know, protect against them. And I have very similar thoughts sometimes too, like, whoa, like it feels bananas sometimes. I think that it's going to come down to, you know, whether or not we can overcome. There are a lot of really good technologies like encryption that can help us. You know, I take a sort of an encryption everywhere type approach. And, you know, basically that's the digital equivalent of you and me whispering into each other's ear, as opposed to what's happening now on networks, which is more or less everybody shouting in a room.
Okay.
So we bring it down to a whisper level. We start whispering to each other, and those kinds of things may help us far more than the way that we've approached network connectivity, commerce, and all of that on the internet so far.
So as you were talking about this, another image flashed into my mind recently. You may have seen it, a video of a robot doing a backflip.
I have not seen this.
This I would recommend. Startling. It's a rather large robot, humanoid in shape, that does a backflip. And there's something about that, as this video was put out there, that captured my imagination and apparently many others. And the reason why I mention that is, as we're talking about how to deal with people as they develop new approaches to hacking, are there in existence now or foreseeable future automated systems that build new hacks or counter hacks in place? How much is this a manual, hands-on type of thing, and are we close to having something that is robotic or AI in nature?
So evolutionary programming, which is what you're describing,
right,
has I think been around in its current form for about 8 years now, 8 or 9 years,
okay,
maybe longer. We don't see, so the tools that we see out there, like Empire, for example, or Link Sniper, or any of those other tools, Metasploit's a fantastic tool. They still have a very much a human component to it. It would not surprise me if or organizations that have access to a lot of capital and can give very smart people nice big paychecks have a tool like that. But in the day-to-day world where, you know, not nation state actors or or otherwise, we don't see anything like that right now.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because that would seem to be where evolution is taking us, so that we don't have to do all of this work ourselves. Create the machine that will create the defense.
Yeah. So, you know, one of my favorite videos, and I have all of our staff watch it, is a gentleman who created a tool. So Empire is a tool that's very much directed at Active Directory networks, which if you have more than a few people in your office and you've got like PCI or something like that, you're using Active Directory typically. And the title of his talk is Death Star, or How I Almost Automated Myself Out of a Job. And he's a hacker. Hey, this is what he does. He's a white hat hacker. So he goes out there, he does these presentations, he finds exploits, and then he enumerates the resolution to them, right? How to is this easy to fix? Is it hard to fix? So he had a bit of a tongue in cheek, but very salient presentation. So it's the automation component is there. One of the areas where AI is challenged is in still in the realm of creativity, which is something that we sometimes run into even with hacking, which is whether or not something that we think has a particular type of application might have another application. You're like, oh gee, you know,
right,
and get in. So how much of penetrating systems is automatable or is something that finding new vulnerabilities as a creative component is still kind of unfolding.
Okay. Well, I know that, that very often the approach to protection starts with the simple things, involving passwords. You know, the way in which passwords are used or abused or underused by saying, I've used the same password for 5 years and haven't gotten in any trouble.
There's a book you recommended to me once, Warnings, right?
Right.
So there's the fallacy of the initial occurrence, right?
Which is, right. Exactly.
Yeah, that's so I cringe when I hear that now, courtesy of your book.
Thank you. Thank you. And the initial occurrence is just because it hasn't happened. You know, that's one of the things that I say, well, it won't happen. And yet then we have that initial occurrence and now we're down the road.
Right. So history is more or less a catalog of initial occurrence and reoccurrence.
Right. Yeah, after time. So we have a few minutes left. We've been talking here for a while, and I know that you operate in this realm. That's what your business is about. Listeners who have gone this far with us, what could you suggest they be thinking about, and or even doing, as this whole world of strike and counter-strike and whatever continues?
There's a number of things that actually, there's some low hanging fruit out there that if we attend to do produce results. So one of the most important pieces of securing oneself is to introduce multi-factor authentication. So if you're in the banking industry, this has been something that's been around for a very long time.
Right. Right?
You get the fob, you get your key. Google has an authenticator. There's a lot of other, and there's a lot more services like Dropbox, and QuickBooks, and a lot of folks. And to explain real quickly what a multi-factor authentication is it's you've got your standard username and password, and then you also have an attendant device, or sometimes it'll be a piece of software on your phone that'll produce a code, or you'll receive a text message with a code. That you'll then enter in to gain access. And DEF CON ran a survey this year, and multi-factor authentication was by far and away the greatest barrier to gaining access to a system. So this is something that requires a little bit of new habits to be formed, but it's almost free. And the only cost that it incurs typically is time.
And I have noticed that within the Apple world, with the new operating systems that have the revisions that have appeared, I've been invited to do multi-factor, and it's a simple check, yes, and then it happens. So as I do something, I get a code sent to my phone. I better have it close by because I'm going to have to take that number and enter it in order to have access to wherever I was going. And initially, I wondered about it. I blithely just said, sure. And then I had that first reaction was, oh, man, I got to do this. I got to make sure I've got the phone nearby, one or my Apple Watch or whatever. And gradually, it became comfortable. And now it's sort of a matter of course, and I'm happy to hear you say what you have, because I was wondering about just how effective that kind of thing was, but it sounds pretty good.
It is really, really effective. There's something called a rainbow table out there, which is a database of all of the passwords that have been compromised. And it's about 72 gigs of text, which, as you can imagine, that's a lot of passwords.
Wow.
And we actually run it internally to make sure the passwords we use haven't been previously compromised by somebody else, because it's a big world out there. There's a lot of people that might have accidentally been using a password that somebody else has used. what multi-factor authentication does is get people away from that type of vulnerability, because the what that number is generated against is against a lot of unique factors that are really hard to track down, including the time.
Right. Okay. Well, Mike Malevsky, I've been here with Peter House, and he somehow simultaneously dwells in two worlds, a digital version of him and a real version. And you do it very successfully. So we're about to finish. Last comments?
The final piece is find a password piece of technology like LastPass or KeyPass to store all of your passwords. Put a good password around that, put multi-factor authentication behind it, and rest easy.
Okay, we will do that. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.